Hello, everybody. This is Matt Dan. You are listening to The Three Interview. And today we are talking to Nicolas Véran, who is one of the co-founders of Bruegel. You may have heard me mention that before, as I also worked there for a time. Nicolas is also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington, D.C. He is, from my perspective, the modern Renaissance man. Not only does he carry out policy-relevant research, he's also a very practical person. He's also someone who is into accounting, the right phrase? I don't know. But somebody who understands accounting and can make international accounting standards sexy, in our air quotes. If you've ever met him, you know that he is a live wire and seemingly has an endless stream of energy. And for that, I have always been an admirer, and I am delighted to welcome him to the podcast. Welcome, Nicola.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
You're in Washington, D.C. right now.
That's correct, and the sky is sunny for once.
And today in Belgium, the sky was also sunny. I'm wearing shorts. It's 19 degrees, and I'm trying to forget that it's February so that I can enjoy it. But given that it's February, we shouldn't be having that kind of weather. Neither of us wants to retell the story of the beginnings of Bruegel, but I do want to talk about some aspects of that. The idea of this podcast is it's a resource for think tankers and nonprofit organization managers. And usually the ones that I work with have smaller budgets and work in less luxurious surroundings than you and I normally do. So what we're trying to do is look at best practice, be inspired by each other, and work out how can I get the best from my minimal budget and resources. So the first thing I wanted to ask you, way back in history, at the conception of Bruegel, one of the things that strikes me about it is that Bruegel occupies a particular niche, and it occupies it so well that it has had no competitors in that niche for its life. How was that niche identified?
Well, first, we weren't always in fancy offices, and Bruegel, a long time ago, and here we mean between 2002 and 2005, essentially, was a startup business. And it was like any startup business, you start with the bootstraps, right? And that was a precarious project before it became established, like I guess any established organization really is, even so they don't necessarily brag about it.
Yeah.
So you ask about how the idea came up, and especially how we spotted a niche, a market opportunity. It was serendipitous, as usual. I can speak for myself. So the story of Bruegel is both Jean Pisani-Ferry and I had some kind of parallel thinking, if you will, about the case for a new European think tank. And then we met at an Italian restaurant in Paris. And we decided to work together after that lunch. And then we took it from there. So I cannot speak for Jean and his own thought process. I can speak for mine. For me, it did come from a trip to the US in the spring of 2002. I had free time on my hands. I was in a transition, as they say politely. Technically, I was on French unemployment insurance, which provided me a good startup subsidy.
Exactly. That's where a lot of entrepreneurs get their start, right?
And I can tell you that for people who had a decent position in the private sector, as I had before going into unemployment, that system was extremely generous, and I would even say outrageously and scandalously so. But, you know, I took the money. And in this case, it genuinely was a startup subsidy. I traveled to the US. I was invited by an acquaintance to spend a little bit of time on my own money at MIT in Cambridge near Boston, Massachusetts. And on the way back, I decided to take a few more days spending them in Washington, D.C., because I had vaguely heard of think tanks. That sounded to me like a bizarre animal, and I wanted to know more. So you know, I contacted a number of friends and colleagues, or former colleagues, rather, in France who had been in contact with those Washington, D.C. think tanks. I said, you know, I'm going to be in D.C. Give me contacts. You know those guys. I don't, and I want to learn more. So I visited them all, more or less, you know, Brookings, Heritage, Cato, Peterson Institute, where Adam Posen kindly greeted me, and a few more. And that's where I had my first contact with that community. And I came back from there thinking, you know, I haven't really interacted with that kind of organization in my former life as a French civil servant. That would be useful to have for civil servants like I used to be.
Yep.
And so I started to look at the Brussels scene. And then I realized that the Brussels scene was not that deep compared with Washington, D.C.
Indeed.
There were a couple of think tanks, but you really could count them on one hand. And it could even be a mutilated hand in a way. And also I realized that none of them would give me a job. And the reason for that was that I didn't really have the kind of profile, especially as somebody who later became a Bruegel senior fellow told yep. me very bluntly, I was not sufficiently Anglo-Saxon. I didn't have the credentials in an English-speaking, internationally connected world because I had been through a very elite, very meritocratic in many ways, certainly very selective system in France, but that was completely insular and wasn't understood or acknowledged outside of the borders of France. So then I started to think, so I think tanks make sense. I don't think the Brussels think tanks are great. In any case, they won't offer me a job. What's the next step? You guessed it. It's about basically, you know, building a business plan. My previous job was in a very entrepreneurial business, mm-hmm. high growth, technology based. And therefore, I started working on a business plan. Literally, I mean, I did, yeah. you know, buy self-help books about how to write a business plan and that kind of thing, like entrepreneurs do.
Yeah. Some of them get MBAs and then become entrepreneurs. But, you know, that's not as exciting as your journey was. So self-help book, business plan for dummies, presumably is what it was called, or something similar.
Exactly. And after a few iterations, I realized that this was not something I could do alone. And this is also typical of an entrepreneurial journey. So I looked for partners, or at least one partner. Mm-hmm. And I knew Jean Pisaniferi from a previous public sector job. I didn't know him very well, but we had been in meetings together. I mean, he knew who I was. We hadn't really worked together on joint projects, but
yep.
there was a relationship to start with. And so I reached out. We made an appointment for the lunch in the Italian restaurant. So
right.
that was only the beginning, of course, because that was only a joint interest to work together on something. So something was defined to the extent I had a draft business plan, but it was not really defined as to the niche, as to your initial question. And for that, we needed a significant more work, which came basically in two stages. The first stage was to identify two or three bullet points that would answer your questions, that would position the project as something that didn't exist.
Yep.
And for that, we positioned it as something at the European level that mm-hmm. would be focused on economic policy, not be a generalist think tank like Brookings looking across the range of public policies, but be something more like the Peterson Institute focused on economics. And also, we thought it was a good idea to do something that would not just be inside Brussels, so connected with the European Commission, EU institutions, European Parliament, and the like, but something that would have connectivity in the member states. And part of this, frankly, was self-interested, because we had, both of us had networks in France. Jean's networks were great. Mine mm-hmm. were slightly complementary. But we didn't have that much of a network outside of France. Jean, of course, had worked at the European Commission, but, you know, there's a lot of competition out there. So we felt that leveraging our French connections could be a strength.
Identifying economics as the area on which the think tank should focus is interesting because neither you nor Jean had initial training as economists, right?
Well, but Jean was an economist by adoption,
yeah.
Something I've become later on.
Yeah.
And actually, that's not entirely true. I mean, he did have initial training.
He'd yeah.
gone circuitously towards economics in his initial training, but he was not as self-trained as I later became.
The point that I am not finally making is that your starting point wasn't to create a platform for the two of you to stand on because it wasn't there or because the other think tanks in Brussels wouldn't give you a job. It was not about you, but it was about identifying where's the hole in this market And there was a big hole there in terms of looking at economic policy. The existing think tanks that were already there or were in the member states and occasionally focusing on European economic policy as a whole. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, I think for both of us, the motivation was primarily demand-driven, if you want to put it that way. We both identified a need that we saw the existing system didn't serve well. And the need was for officials in the EU institutions and in the member states to get the kind of ideas, data, discussions, advice, and recommendations that we thought good think tanks should provide, and that the existing think tanks didn't provide that well, with all due respect, of course, and I don't want to trash them. And we felt we could help. We had what it takes to, you know, build something that would be helpful in that space.
It's a similar story to our previous interviewee, Milena Lazarevic from CEP in Belgrade. And there she described not only did they have to create the supply, but they also kind of had to create the demand amongst policymakers in Serbia for a think tank. Were you entering a space where the demand was there? Were there people in the member states? Were there people in the institutions who were looking to get better economic advice?
Yeah, and so this may be, in that sense, a difference. And actually, that was Jean's motivation primarily. So my motivation came from my trip to the U.S. He also had the U.S. as a point of comparison. And his way of putting it, because he had been in all those, you know, international policy coordination meetings like the G7 and, you know, the International Monetary Fund annual meetings, that kind of things, which is an experience I didn't have from my short career in the civil service. He had seen the American system in action. He had observed that in the U.S., the think tanks were helping create a consensus on a number of policy positions upstream, if you will, at an early stage of the international discussion. And so there would be a very adversarial, very vibrant discussion inside the system in the U.S., and then a consensus would be formed, and then all the U.S. stakeholders in these discussions would come up with basically coordinated positions. And that gave them enormous strength in international discussions, whereby not only were the Europeans divided between themselves, but even in a single EU member state, there was no such consensus because there was not the infrastructure to create it. So that's a bit of a simplification, of course, because there are other platforms, other institutions of consensus building in every European country. But for the purposes of the kind of policy discussions that he had experienced, he felt the US system was superior and there was a lot to learn from it. That's where the demand is, because these observations he had been able to make, he had not been alone in making them. So basically among the more internationally exposed, internationally oriented, if you will, internationally enlightened segment of the French civil service, and likewise in other member states, there were other people who had the same experience, the same frustrations, and the same aspirations, and we could build on that.
So you talked about your three bullet points, which basically would be able to position, identify Bruegel, and presumably sell Bruegel. Given that one of my roles at Bruegel was to take over from you to do a number of the day-to-day running things, including looking after money, one of the things that really impressed me when I looked back in Bruegel's books in order to be able to keep them as well as you did, you raised a lot of money before you began operations. And I suspect that a lot of think tanks begin operations and doing research and then go, oh, I can't, you know, I need money to be able to do this. I can't do my full-time job during the day, write a policy paper at night and still have a good life. Is that the case? And presumably that was a deliberate choice.
That's right. And that makes Bruegel's story both interesting and atypical, because most think tanks start as you described. There's one person or more often a group of people, and, you know, they start having really good ideas and they write a really good paper and then the rest is history. That's not how we did it. And that was a deliberate choice because we felt we wanted to build a platform with many stakeholders from the start. Mm-hmm. And we knew that assembling all those stakeholders together would be difficult. Yep. Would be a full-time job, didn't give us a space to neither to write good papers nor to have a good life. It's not just that we raised a lot of money before you came up, it's that we worked a lot before you came up. You arrived in early 2006. Mm-hmm. The restaurant lunch, which is essentially the starting point for our Bruegel, the rest is prehistory, was in October 2002. There were more than 3 years, almost 3.5 years between those 2 points.
Yeah.
And what happened between those 2 points was actually a lot of things and a lot of work. So there were many steps between this first stage that I described before, this meeting of mine and the creation of a few bullet points, and the point where we had all this money in the bank.
I know that you said that it was atypical, and I don't want to jump to the end of the story, but do you think that in those steps from 2002 to 2006, there are some useful ideas, some useful stories, some facts that you can relate that might be relevant to young small think tanks right now in terms of raising money and operations?
Absolutely. And let me mention at least two of them. First, I mentioned that the three bullet points were the first stage. Because three bullet points don't give you an identity. An identity is something more complex. And so we had a lot of work to do after that. Even so, we never departed from those three bullet points, and they are still there.
Yep.
But we had a lot of work to do on top of that to really define a concept that would not just make sense to us, but that would make sense to anybody we could, you know, talk to in an elevator, as the cliche has it. And for this, we were extraordinarily lucky because we weren't just on our own. A third person joined us, a consultant called Soizic Bevan. Her background was in PR, communication, corporate strategy. She really liked the project. She liked our three bullet points. She understood them.
Yeah.
And he volunteered to work pro bono with us very hard. We had many, many sessions. It was a lot of hard work to just refine the concept, give us values, an identity, some founding principles, things that are not the governance, not the funding model, but really about who we are, why we choose to be that, and how we make it work.
Yeah.
That took not just months, it took more than a year to get to that point where we really could deploy in a concrete, compelling way the identity of Bruegel in a way that would appeal to fundraisers beyond people whom, to cut a long story short, we already had a relationship. So that's the first point I wanted to mention. The second point, which is related, is the fact that, as I said, we wanted a very diverse platform of stakeholders from the start. And to be more specific, we wanted to have a number of EU member states and a number of private sector participants, essentially companies.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that we felt, and actually we knew from our previous experiences, that if you had a purely private sector model in the European context, which is different for that from the US, you would be captured by the corporate interest.
Yep.
And conversely, if you were all public sector money, you would become bureaucratized and politicized by the diplomatic compromises that those guys negotiate between themselves, because that's the way it works. So in order to break those two molds, in order to escape those two dead ends, we had to find a healthy mix between public and private money. That was our reasoning, and that's actually the way it has worked. So we had a lot of discussion on exactly how to engineer it. Should there be an endowment, a foundation model? Should it be more subscriptions? In a way, we found a kind of compromise between these two concepts. Maybe we'll come back to that. But the bottom line is we basically needed our initial fundraising to address two very different types of stakeholders. One were the governments, and the other were the companies. And we wanted both of them. So what we did, and this is where I think there are lessons which may have some read across for other projects, is that we took them not all together, not all at the same time, but sequentially. So, that was partly serendipity, but it was also partly strategy.
Mm-hmm.
We decided we would go first with the governments. We would basically do all the fundraising we wanted to do with governments. And once we had that in the bag, we would go to the companies and persuade them on that basis. And that's exactly how it worked in practice, but it was a very long protracted sequence. So we started reaching out to governments in late 2002, so a couple of weeks after the launch, and initially just France and Germany.
Yep.
And because there was an opportunity for that, which was a French-German summit in January 2003. And then we enlarged to all European member states. We were very ambitious. So, you know, we organized our own mini council meetings, you know, yep. Borrowing rooms from, it was very funny to do, by the way.
Yep.
Lots of anecdotes. And more than a year later, in March 2004, 18 months after the initial launch, we secured the first formal step of agreement at Google, which was an agreement of 12 governments, including critically all the large member states, so Germany, France, also the UK, which was difficult, Italy, Spain, the Netherlands, etc. And these guys said, okay, you got what you wanted. We're ready to give you money, but on the condition, and we'll give you some seed money, where we will only deploy the real money if you manage to build on our commitment and raise funds from the private sector, have a critical mass of corporate funding before the end of the year, before the end of 2004. So that was perfect. This was structured very much like, you know, some private sector startup development deals, where you think of the next step while you're negotiating the first one, and that created the right incentives.
A number of organizations that I work with, they work in a national context rather than an international context. Often the government, even though it's the government that you are trying to change, improve, help, often the government is not open to that. And certainly taking money from the government in a national context could be difficult, let's say. And these same organizations also often work in an economy where the private sector isn't very, very well established. And it probably has other informal ways to reach the government and doesn't perhaps need a think tank to do it. Can you see parallels for those kinds of organizations? Is the principle, don't just take your money from one person, one pot? For a lot of these people, the balance in their funding is, you know, they take a little bit from USAID and they take a little bit from the European Union, maybe a little bit from Japan or China if they're lucky. Given where you are in think tanks now, how does that principle apply to think tanks working in a national context?
Well, I don't think there's a magic formula in any sense. And clearly the magic of Bruegel is precisely that it's easier to get the diversity of funding sources when you operate at the European scale. And indeed, that was part of the reason, by the way, we wanted to involve member states and not just EU institutions. Because if we were seeking money from EU institutions, we would fall into the same trap that you mentioned for a national think tank. We would be in the hands of the European Commission one way or another. And frankly, without naming names, some think tanks in Brussels are in that situation. And we didn't want that for ourselves. Mm. So we found a formula that would embed the diversity of funding sources hardwired in the way Bruegel was built in a way that was almost unbreakable. And that has worked beautifully. Now, in the national context, you have to think of something different, because clearly what we did is not something you can replicate. I mean, perhaps in federally organized countries, like, you know, I don't know, you could imagine in Germany or Switzerland doing something comparable, or Canada, but most countries are not like that. And even in the US, I don't think it would work, for example. I think we had extreme diversity from the start.
Yep.
We didn't have a single source at more than 5 or 6% from the first year of operations, which is quite unique. And I think that's putting the bar, frankly, too high for the typical think tank project. I think it's a completely general principle for think tanks that diversity is a good thing to have if you can have it.
Yep.
And the way you try to get it depends completely on circumstances. And I don't think there is any general formula for it. Obviously, looking for philanthropic sources in principle is preferable than looking for government sources in most environments.
Yep.
That wasn't the case for us, but it's the case in generally. But that's easier said than done.
Yeah, I think the one-word answer to my very long question is diversity. And no matter what niche you're seeking to fill, how you're going to raise your money, you should be thinking about diversity from the beginning. And the experience of organizations that I work with is that without that diversity, you run the risk of running into problems when money dries up. So if we look at the US, for example, a lot of people who would have got funding from USAID over the last 4 years, it would have been cut for the last 4 years. It'll come back now.
Two more points on this, because this is really important. And here we're talking about general lessons. One is, I personally believe diversity is more important than any particular balance between public and private.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I think it's more important to have several sources of funding than to target the public or the private sector as a matter of principle. And the reason for that is just that when you only have one or one dominant source of funding, no matter whether it's public or private, it will want to instrumentalize you. And that's a completely general thing. It's also true of individuals. It's true of foundations. It's true of companies. It's true of asset management funds. No matter, and of course, of government agencies, including foreign aid agencies. So if you want to be independent, if you want to be your own organization and not be in the hands or clutches or whatever is a metaphor of one third party, then you need to diversify.
Yeah.
The second point, which you hinted at, but which I think is also very important, it's very difficult to change your identity when you already have one.
Yeah.
So if you start... One typical thing that I've observed over the years is people who say, okay, and that's very much into European context, but we'll drive broader lessons here. People say, okay, my buddies and I, we're, say, French, we'll start our thing in France, and once we're big enough, then we'll expand in Europe and we'll become European or global.
Yeah.
Typically, that doesn't work that way, because once, after a few years of being... let's assume they're successful or successful French think tanks, you know, they have embedded habits, identities, values, modes of operation, which will be difficult to transpose in an international context or even just a European one. By the way, that's why we put Bruegel in Brussels. I mean, both Jean and I, we're Parisians. The kind of comfort zone and least effort solution would have been to start from Paris.
Yeah.
Instead, we started from Brussels, even when we didn't know anybody there. So we would take the Thalys and go to Brussels just for the sake of being there, because that's where we wanted to be long term.
Yeah.
We did have some meetings in Paris, including in Jean's kitchen, but not in mine, because I'm a terrible cook. But we had that concern, really. I mean, in a way, it was defensive, that if we started leveraging our French links in too exclusive a way, we would never escape from France.
Yeah.
And the point I'm making here, in a way, reads across to financing only to a limited extent. I think there are stories of think tanks which started with a dominant financing source and which managed to diversify away. And to a large extent, that's the case of the Peterson Institute, which started, I think, with dominant funding of the German Marshall Fund, even so I don't have the exact numbers. But I think it's really important for the entrepreneurs of a new think tank to be paranoid about that, because otherwise, I mean, the gravity of your initial funder can really drag you down. At the time we worked on Bruegel, there was a recent example which was in everybody's mind in Brussels, which has now been, I think, completely forgotten, which was the Philip Morris Institute in the 90s in Brussels. So Philip Morris, the tobacco company, for understandable reasons, said, yeah, we want to, you know, build a better image in Brussels. So they gave a pot of money to a think tank, which was completely independent. They gave them, I mean, they understood the reputational issues. So they said, you do what you want to do. We want you to succeed. And we give you the seed money, and if you're successful, we'll get credit from there.
Yep.
But essentially, they never had the escape velocity.
Yep.
And it was a sad story, because actually they had independence, they had good people, but they couldn't escape from this initial identity. So now that's, of course, a bit of a special example, because tobacco companies are merchants of death. But still, I think for us, it was a very interesting cautionary tale.
There are other merchants of death available who are desperate to give money away too, if you're willing to take it. I think we're moving now on to the second point that I wanted to talk about. And that was, you talked about how once you have an identity, it's really hard to escape it. And we know that from our personal lives. You know, our families have very different ideas of who we are as people, even 50 years later, because they remember something you did when you were 5 years old. It's very clear to me that a lot of thought, a lot of time went into imagining and making the identity of Bruegel and building a brand, building a strong brand. And if I remember, I don't remember exactly what the situation was that we experienced together in Bruegel, but I do remember what you said to me, and that was, you know, this brand is strong enough to withstand whatever it was. And I don't even remember what that what it was.
Well, there are many such moments because I've said that many different times.
Yeah. Yeah. And it stuck, Nicola. Well done. I think that's a really important point. Can you do that with less money? Is this something that smaller think tanks in a national context can, you know, do some really good work on that will stand them in good stead in 5 years' time?
Oh, absolutely. What I referred to in those conversations, of which there were many, was the magic of the brand. And this is something I learned with Bruegel. Actually, anybody who has been in business school knows that because you learn that in business school, but I didn't. Right. I didn't have that experience. The power of it was really a lesson for me that I learned really by doing.
Right.
So we knew that the brand was important. We knew that we needed to get that one right. And so we gave ourselves time. So the first 2 years of Bruegel, it wasn't called Bruegel. We called it, we tried to find a name that would be so clunky that it would have no chance to stick and that we could credibly say this was a code name for something that would take a permanent name later on. So it was a project for a European Center for International Economics. And that's how Bruegel was registered as an organization. That's how all the dozens of meetings that led to its initial establishment were headlined. And it worked. So that gave us a space as we were negotiating the platforms, the stakeholders, the initial money, we were at the same time trying to find a good brand. And by and large, we failed. So we did a number of focus groups and stuff. And I mentioned that generous consultant, Swazik Bevon, and she organized stuff for us. And we spent a lot of time. And the ideas we came up with were miserable. One thing we knew is we didn't want a 3 or 4 letter acronym because Brussels was full of that.
Yeah.
But we wanted something that people would remember. But we couldn't find the good names. I won't even tell you the names we came up with because they were ridiculous. So they're Bruegel's best kept secrets.
Yep.
They should stay that way. Mario Monti, who in the meantime had accepted to be our first board chairman, came up with this idea of Bruegel, and that succeeded very well.
We can't all hire Mario Monti. And indeed, he wasn't paid for that. I think it's important to say. The important point for me, and it's one of the things I loved to talk about when I was at Bruegel, was that wherever you are in the world, you don't want a letter acronym unless it spells a 4-letter word that everyone's going to remember. In the European context, there are so many organizations with a C in them for center, an E in them for European, and a P in them for policy.
Mario Monti gave us a gift to Jean and me.
Yeah.
It's probably somewhere in the library of Bruegel. He gave us the Dictionary of Brussels Acronyms with a preface by a tongue-in-cheek preface by Romano Prodi.
Yeah.
And you have them all. And you're so right, because acronyms like, say, our fellow and beloved peer think tank EPC, there are 4 or 5 organizations in Brussels which have the acronym EPC. So it's an extreme location for that. I think, you know, 3-letter acronyms can work in other places.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily a great brand, but they can work. And some of them are really good brands, but in Brussels, it couldn't work. So our choice was very Brussels specific in that way.
I was thinking 3-letter brands like BMW, for example. But at the beginning, that probably wasn't how it was branded. Along with the name, I walked into an organization that also had a very clear visual identity. Not only that, but you had thought about how do we make our policy products easy to consume, attractive to look at, all of those things smaller think tanks can do, right?
Absolutely, because the secret of that is not money, it's work. And small think tanks have that.
Yeah.
It's work and drive and the willingness to be the best. and to be world class. Right. And I think you can do that at any scale, especially these days where you have, you know, a technology that enables that. So we were extremely ambitious. We wanted to be at least at the same level as the best US think tanks and, if possible, beat them. We didn't want to be parochial. We had that expression initially,
right,
with the Harvard feel, because when you're from Europe and you go to your first seminar at Harvard, generally you have this feeling that, you know, these guys do it really well. And the quality of the conversation, the quality of the way people interact, it's something that you're not used to in Europe, where, you know, people are more stuffy, they speak too long, they give too much respect to each other, that kind of thing. So that was our code. We want the Harvard feel. We want people who come to Bruegel to have the feeling that they're in a conversation of the best possible quality in the world.
Yeah.
And that kind of ambition and energy you can have anywhere at any scale. It's just a matter of what drives you. It's not a matter of how much money you have.
I think that's wonderful. So I'm really happy to have heard you say that you did do some learning by doing, because I think that that's going to be inevitable for whoever starts a think tank.
But also, if you allow me to interrupt you,
yep,
we gave ourselves time. So the things you mentioned, we already talked about the brand and the way we deliberately delayed the choice of the brand to a pretty late point of the development of Bruegel, after we had the funding, after we had the governance, after we had the chairman, after we had the stakeholders. And then at that point, we did the brand and we adopted the name Bruegel. And that's, by the way, when the project was announced to the world. So the project had been non-public, not particularly secret, but not public before that. And it was the first time it went public, it had a brand. Which was Bruegel, the very same day. But we still didn't have a logo, for example. You mentioned our visual identity that came, I don't remember, 3 to 6 months later. We worked with a very talented designer, Jean-Yves Verdu, who had been referred to us by Soazic Bevan. So that was the same connection. He was French, but very immersed in Brussels. Actually, he got more immersed in Brussels thanks to us, I think, later on. I don't remember the chronology very well. Anyway, he was super good, and he built our visual identity, but that was at a pretty late stage. And the same for the layout of our products. You mentioned the user experience, etc. So different stories in different cases, but in our case, one thing that enabled us to reach this high quality was that we didn't try to do everything at once. We gave ourselves space and time to do the difficult things at a later stage, and only when we really couldn't do without them.
I find that interesting, and I would encourage all of our listeners to rewind a little bit and listen to the way you listed how you went down those things. A lot of what I'm doing with organizations is kind of retrofitting a number of those aspects, like governance, like oversight from another organization, like creating stakeholders that weren't there from the beginning. And I have to say, if you're retrofitting all of that stuff, it's really difficult. And, you know, if you are thinking of starting a think tank, then do it the way Nicholas has done. If you don't manage to do it the way Nicholas has done, I can help you with the retrofitting, but it's not an easy exercise.
No, it's not easy. And frankly, I wouldn't generalize anything, because I think every situation is different and you really have to start from the entrepreneur, from the project, from the situation. So for example, I mean, we did it that way, frankly, because we were without a personal brand at the scale of the space we wanted to cover, which was European.
Right. Did we even talk about personal brands 20 years ago? I think that you'll find a lot of people in smaller organizations who are seeking to do this, who are writing policy papers, they need to do what they need to think about branding, as you said, because their personal brand is small.
But I think Bruegel is an extreme example and not necessarily transferable to other cases because of the extreme way in which we delayed production and gratification. Our first paper by André Sapir was published in September 2005, almost 3 years after the launch, and more than 3 years after, certainly speaking for myself, I started to obsess about the project.
Yep.
3 years, that's a very long time. I don't think that's applicable to other projects. I think in a way we're a complete outlier there, and others should not try to emulate that, because that was just fit for our circumstances, which were quite unique.
Yep.
So I think there can be inspiration to be drawn from that experience and certainly lessons, but I wouldn't offer it as a model. I would offer it just as a point of comparison.
Yep. We have about 10 minutes more. There was something else that I wanted to ask you about. You are in, I think, a fairly unique position in that you work with a European think tank and you work with a US think tank, and you sometimes literally straddle the Atlantic. What have you learned by working in those two areas? Now, you know, we have to acknowledge that they're both quite well-developed think tank sectors and also quite well-funded. But what have you learned? Can you compare and contrast them? Are there lessons that we can learn from US think tanks and apply to European, and European think tanks and apply to US ones?
In a way, I think this should be a whole episode of your series, right? I mean, not necessarily.
Well, we can do that. You can do the introduction now. And
there are lots of questions here. You can think about the funding. You can think about the management. You can think about the communication. You can think about the way you organize discussions, the way you engage with stakeholders. And in each of these critical areas, I think you will find interesting points to compare and contrast. Let's take those five, right? Funding, governance, management, communication, and engagement of stakeholders. I mean, pick the one you prefer, because otherwise there's too much to discuss.
The one that I think would most immediately be relevant, and I accept your invitation to invite you again to talk about this at length. I always had the impression when I was working in a think tank that, apart from Bruegel, which was always ahead of the field, I got the impression that US think tanks are faster to work on the things around research that make the research easier to distribute or so on. So for example, you know, the management is better, the communication is better, they're quicker to adopt new platforms. I always thought it was because they had more money and more staff, and so they were able to have someone to just play on Twitter all day. Sorry, not play, work on Twitter all day. But I'm not sure that that's actually the case.
These things are complex, and I think there's always a risk of overgeneralizing. And I certainly wouldn't say that, you know, all US think tanks are better than all European think tanks. That's not the case. I think it is true that in general, and that's actually documented by very good academic studies, U.S. management culture is pretty good. That's one of the things that makes the U.S. what it is. And organizations in the U.S. build on a common culture that starts, frankly, at preschool, if not earlier, that allows for better functioning organizations.
Yeah,
and by contrast, in Europe, you often have legacies of very top-down, very patriarchal, very occasionally bureaucratic. But I don't think bureaucratism is the main problem. I think it's more the kind of top-down model, which often comes from the fact that in many of our European environments, the organizations that preceded all others was the military.
Or royalty.
And top down. So I mean, again, I'm generalizing already too much, but I think you cannot separate your specific concern of think tanks from the broader issues that also applies to companies, government agencies, and essentially any organization.
Yeah.
So then, if you control for that, then you see perhaps less difference between Europeans and Americans, but that's a big difference, which is completely structural.
Yeah. It brings to mind one of the things that I like to work on with my clients is to try and separate the management responsibilities from the research responsibilities. A number of think tanks in the US do that very well. They have professional managers while still maintaining that the figureheads, the leaders of the organization, not only are, let's say, decent managers, but they're also good researchers. They're also focal points for the organization. But apart from that very top level, would you endorse that comment that if you can, you should try and separate the management from the research, given that you've done it all?
I mean, I think to have the best researchers, you should relieve them as much as possible from management duties. But that's a luxury, and it's a luxury that not everybody has. And frankly, in the US, there are very few think tanks that really do that.
Right.
So many, most US think tanks have a model which will be familiar to our listeners, I guess, which in the US is called eat what you kill. And that means that the researchers, you know, they
have to raise their own money. Yeah.
They may parade as elegant swans on the media, but like swans, they're pedaling furiously below the surface in order to parade. And the pedaling is spending a lot of their time and energy and mental energy on fundraising, because that's their program. And if they don't do the fundraising themselves, their program will die. Now, at the Peterson Institute, to speak for that organization, certainly we're very fortunate to have the completely opposite model, in which essentially the fundraising is completely centralized. So that's a burden for our president, and we're very grateful to him. Thank you, Adam. And the rest of us have to help him to the extent we can. So whenever he asked us to do something for a supporter, the financial supporter, we know that's the highest priority for us. But we don't have really to think about it, because he does it for us. That's an extraordinary luxury. But even in the US, it's only a very small minority of think tanks that has that luxury. So I think this is very important to keep in mind. And indeed, I think in most think tanks, you have to make more compromises to understand that you will need your research people to also be involved, if not in administration, certainly in development, because there's no other way to go. So I feel extraordinarily fortunate, and frankly, that's why I work to a large extent at Bruegel and at the Peterson Institute. These are two organizations that leave me, I paid my duties at Bruegel by helping to set it up and to manage it in the early years and develop it. But now, and actually that's been the case for more than a decade, I'm 100% a research person, and I rely on the Bruegel infrastructure, even so I'm happy to help when I can with fundraising, but that's not in my job description. And similarly, in the Peterson Institute, I'm happy to do more than my share if I can to fundraise, but that's not what I'm paid for. But that's a big luxury, and I don't think that can be extrapolated to most think tanks. And that's also true in the US.
Yeah. It brings to mind one more area where I think the US does very well, and indeed Bruegel does very well, and that's the level of support under the researchers, the number of research assistants, interns, and so on. Do you see any differences between Europe and the US? And would you recommend that this would be something that any think tank should look into? Because it would appear to be something which is lower cost, but could have a potential to expand your output greatly without having to buy in a big researcher.
Well, one thing that I will slightly backpedal from my previous response is, I'm an economist by adoption, but an economist now, and I think in terms of comparative advantage.
Yeah.
And that's true in any organization, especially in think tanks, but like so many other organizations and companies, you have to focus on talent. You need the best talent. You need to get the best value from your talent. For that, you have to really identify where the value lies, where the talent lies, and how you can best leverage it. So this is not because you want just to make people happy, even so you may want that, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is for the sake of your organization.
Yep.
You need people who have talent in a particular area to be able to focus their work in that area, because that's how your organization will benefit most. I think that's a universal principle, and it works no matter what you look at. So when I said you have to compromise out of necessity, even that actually, the truth is more nuanced, and actually it's also more nuanced at Bruegel and at the Peterson Institute. I think you may identify some of your research staff that you really don't want to bother with administrative or development duties because they're not going to be good at it and they will hate it. And others where you can have more of a mix.
Yep.
But I think this runs across the range of functions and skills and preferences. So, for example, especially for small organizations, I think it's critically important to understand for each of your staff what they might be good at, what they might be motivated with, what might give them a sense of personal fulfillment in their job, and really try to match it with your organizational needs, because otherwise you will lose a lot of potential. And that's why I was critical of the traditional European top-down culture, because that's what the top-down culture typically doesn't do. They say, well, I have this person, under that job description and they tick the box. And I don't care what makes them tick because that's their job.
Yep.
But that's not a good way to extract value from resources you have for well-being of your organization.
Yep. Thank you. It's been wonderful to hear basically an injection of entrepreneurial spirit into how to build a good think tank. It's great to talk to an adopted economist who thinks about competitive advantage. I couldn't say I'm an adopted economist, but I certainly know a lot more about economics than when I first started at Bruegel in 2006. Is there anything you would like to add that you think would be important to share that I didn't ask you about?
Well, we didn't talk a lot about the entrepreneur, him or herself, what makes them tick, what motivates them. In a way, it's a paradoxical thing, right? Because we're talking about nonprofits. With Jean, we used to joke that, you know, too bad we don't have stock options because we are creating a lot of value here. And I think this question of motivations, but again, very personal, not something you can generalize, it's very important for the entrepreneur to understand themselves, to know what will give them reward and fulfillment.
Yep.
And I think this is something that think tank leaders have to think very hard about because, you know, developing an organization is a thankless job.
Yep.
And when you don't even have the prospect of untold riches if you succeed, which is the case in think tanks, you have to think hard of what you really want. And that piece is better done upfront because otherwise you're in for a journey of discoveries that might not be entirely happy.
In my experience, a lot of people are motivated by wanting to improve a situation, by wanting to make the situation of others better. And I think what I'm hearing from you is that it takes a very particular kind of driven person who is willing to do the work, who is lucky and who has the time to be able to do that. And if that's not you, you might, you know, consider volunteering at the secondhand shop or at the food bank or something like that. And that's the way you can.
Well, I didn't say that because that's...
No, I'm being a little bit
already too systematic.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that we told about staff, research staff, non-research staff, how to leverage their skills and talents for the best purpose of the organization. But I think the truth is, especially in a new organization, no person is more important than the entrepreneur or entrepreneurs who create it. And they're human. They're complicated. They have trade-offs to manage, different complicated sets of motivations. And that shouldn't be a blind spot in the analysis.
Okay. I think that's an excellent place to finish. And that will also keep us within the time limit that that people like to listen. Nicola, thank you. Thank you for today. On a personal basis, thank you so much for the experiences that I got from Bruegel. A lot of them were to do with you. And I, as I say, I walked into a wonderful position. Yes, that was down to Jean, but the part of the work that I did for Bruegel was down to you. And it was very clear that not only had you spent a lot of time thinking about it, but you know, the execution was also excellent.
Well, let me interrupt you here because I don't want to bother our listeners too much with, you know, mutual praise. But, you know, you brought so much to Bruegel over a very long period with very hard work, but also with a lot of creativity and imagination. And I learned a lot from you. So I want to make this really reciprocal.
Thank you. So creativity and imagination will be the themes of our next talk when we do. Thank you again for your time, Nicola. I am looking forward to seeing you in person at some point when COVID and our governments allow us to. And in the meantime, keep doing what you're doing and stay safe.
And likewise to you. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you.